Good morning, everybody. So let's start off with questions. Anybody got any questions about anything? Has anybody actually looked at the practical assignment? Yes? Anybody burst into tears? No, it's an, I'm sorry. But it's an easy practical assignment. It's just kind of a warm-up exercise. Yeah, but it is work. I agree, it is work. Okay. Well, we've been building up towards object recognition for several lectures. And here's our set of objects. We've got just three here. In real life, we may have more. I have a skin cancer research project in which we have five different types of objects. We're using some technologies pretty similar to what we're talking about here in the lecture, sort of Bayesian classifier. It's structured into a hierarchy rather than in a sort of flat where we do all the classes at the same time. But nonetheless, it is a little bit similar to this. We're also, I've also got from one of my fish detection, tracking, and recognition project, our team is responsible for some of the recognition. And in that particular case, we have about 1,500 different classes of fish that could potentially appear in our videos. And I think that's a case where we probably will not use exactly what you see right here. You can't have sort of one level and then 1,500 possibilities. The blurring between the classes is just too much. So I think we're going to have to structure the object recognition problem in that case in a slightly more complicated way. But nonetheless, I think the Bayesian methods that we're looking at here are sort of a core to at least part of that problem as well. Okay, so we've got these test objects, and because I was lazy when I collected the data for this lecture, I only took four pictures of each of these three, so I only have 12 pictures, and as I say, I'm going to be bad, because I'm going to use these four instances both for the training process and then I'm going to use it for the test process afterwards. Okay, but really what you should be doing if you're doing any real experiments, you should be training and testing on independent sets of data. Okay, and I happen to know how many there are of each, so I can calculate the a priori probability of each of these three classes, and here we'll assume they're equal. Okay, so here's a little bit more drill on MATLAB. This is the code, pretty much all the code there is for training the classifiers. Okay, so we'll go through. There's not too much new MATLAB here that we haven't seen before. Okay, so we're only going to use three properties. That's because we only have four samples of each of the different classes. So at most, we can use three properties so we don't overtrain. I need to input the model file name. This is where I'm going to be storing the statistical models that I've learned, the mean vectors and the covariance matrices. So as before, we use MATLAB prompt input statement with a prompt string right here. Notice the embedded carriage return that leaves a little question mark on the next line as a kind of prompt. And we're going to input a string. Here we're going to use the input again. In this case, we're going to input the number of classes. That'll be our three. And all of my image files have the same first bit of their file name, and I need to know what that first bit of the file name is. So here I'm prompting again for the stem of that file name. Okay, here's the number of training images. Sorry, that was number of classes and number of training images. And then I just loop over all of the images to get my training data. I use the MATLAB imread command. Remember this sort of bracket convention here where we can construct the string which we pass to MATLAB to be executed. So this has got our file stem name right up here. And then I needed to take my image number because the files are named sort of F1, F2, F3, F4, et cetera. And I need to append the image number right here. My loop is going in terms of integers, and I need to convert the integers to string. So that's something that's new here. So that converts, so I got my F right here, I've got my 1 right here, and I also append a .jpeg at the end, so that gives me a file name, f1.jpeg. And also here's the type. So that reads it in. These were color images, so I've got a RGB image right here. I want to work in gray, so I use the MATLAB convert RGB to gray command. Okay, that gives me the image I'm going to work with. I have a function, which I'm not going to go through here, called extract properties, but it uses basically the area parameter and the invariant moments and things like that that we've discussed in sort of in the theory in the previous lectures. So I pass in my current image. These other arguments here are to tell it to pop up various windows for drawing images of intermediate results, and in this case I don't want any. Since I'm doing a supervised training process here, I need to tell it what the true class is for each of these images. So that's the another input prompt right here. And finally, so that gets me all of the, it processes all the images one by one, gets me all the features extracted. Okay, they're stored in this thing called vector here. And now I need to build my statistical model. That's where I calculate the mean vector and the covariance matrices. So that's a little function right here. I think we'll look at that one in just a minute. Okay, that gives me my mean vectors, my covariance matrices. Actually, I've taken the inverse of them because I want to work with the inverse. And my a priori probabilities for each of the classes. And finally, I want to save all of this model structure because I may come back and want to use all the model that I've learned the next day, or you know, evaluate it again and again and again. So I want to save the models that I've learned. Okay, so that's, again, I sort of pack up one of these strings and I embed in it the file name, and then I execute it. Okay, so that's really all the training code right there. There's a little bit of technical detail buried in the extract props and the build model. But really, the overall structure is very straightforward, as you can see. This is the build model code, and actually it's pretty straightforward as well, too. Okay, it's going to output three arguments. This is something that maybe we haven't talked about in MATLAB. A lot of programming languages that you may be used to when you have subroutines that are effectively functions, you know, they return a value. Well, MATLAB can return more than one value, and that's what's happening right here. It's returning three different results. Okay, so that says this list of results is what's going to come out of this build model function. Sorry, something's gone wrong right up here. There should be three dots rather than just one dot right there. I don't know what went wrong there, but if you see anything wrong in the notes, be sure to tell me. I mean, that one's probably been sitting there for 5 years, and you know, finally I noticed. So, right. Okay, so here's our function, and we're going to loop over the classes because we're going to need a mean vector and a covariance matrix and an a priori probability for each of the three classes. So we're going to loop over the classes right here. Here's another use of that find command. Okay, so right now I'm going to work with initially class number one. So it says, well, let's search all of the ground truth that I passed in from my supervised training, and let me find all the data samples that correspond to this first class. So that gives me an index, in samples is going to be a set of indexes into this array, okay, where all of the particular values have I. So it says, okay, maybe the first sample is from class one, and the seventh sample and the eighth sample are from class one, and maybe the 11th or something. So it'll have 1, 7, 8, and 11 in here. Okay, I want to know how many samples I've got, so I can look at the length of this array. I want to pull out all of the vectors, all the data vectors that correspond to those samples from that class. So here is a little bit more complicated MATLAB. Okay, I use this array here as an index, so that pulls out all the appropriate elements of the vex array. And this colon right here says pull out all the values. So this is my feature vector, and it says, this basically says all the features for these particular samples. Okay, so that gives me the set of data vectors for this particular class. I want to know the mean vector, okay. I just use the MATLAB mean command, store it into my result array. I want to compute the covariance matrix. So I need to, if you remember back to our formula, the covariance matrix is formed by an outer product of the data vector minus the mean vector. So this is a kind of clever way of subtracting that mean vector from all of the data vectors at the same time. So I create an m by 1 array and multiply it by the mean vector, which gives me an m by d matrix, and I subtract that matrix from all of the data matrix right here. So MATLAB is really good about this. I could have written a little loop to do all of that, but that would be, although it may be clearer, it's also more computationally inefficient. Okay, and MATLAB's got a lot of these sort of array type operations built in to allow you to do things more efficiently. Okay, so that gives me the difference between all of my data vectors and the mean vector. And I want to do my outer product, so I do that right like this. Okay, notice here the transpose to sort of flip the matrix over. So that will give me, right now this is an M by 3 matrix, and you do all this together and gives me a 3 by 3 matrix. I do my scaling by M minus 1 because I've got M samples and I wanted to have a statistically unbiased, so the statistics say divide by M minus 1. That gives me my estimated matrix. I then take the inverse of that. MATLAB's got a built-in inverse command, and then I stuff it into this array. So this is another example of where you can do stuff quite conveniently in MATLAB. Inverse covariance matrix is a 3 by 3 matrix indexed on which class, and then the sort of it's a three-dimensional matrix indexed by the class, and then the 3 by 3 covariance matrices. And I'm copying that whole covariance matrix over into this array just by using these two colons right here. It sort of says, you know, copy the corresponding elements, you know, of this 3 by 3 matrix into that 3 by 3 matrix. So again, it's kind of convenient. You could do that with a loop, copying them over one at a time, as you probably would do in, you know, Java or Fortran or C or something like that. But MATLAB allows you to just copy the whole thing at once. Finally, we estimate the a priori probability by taking the number of samples in this class, that's m, and dividing by the total number of data samples from that got passed in. So that's our estimate of the a priori probability. Okay, so again, this looks pretty straightforward. Any questions? Oh, sorry, yeah.
So the line of the line transvector to the vector sample is the vector of the indices of the members of the class.
That's right, yeah.
And then what you get back is a one-dimensional vector?
Class vector will be a two-dimensional vector. You'll have I can't remember whether it's a row or a column, but let's say it's a column. You'll get one column for each of the indexes in this sample array. And that column will consist of the three properties associated with that model, or with that piece of data. So it's an array of sort of a data vector this way versus number of samples that way, or possibly transposed. I can't do all this on the fly in my head. But fortunately, MATLAB will tell you when you get it wrong. So when you try and multiply things that have the wrong dimensions, it'll let you know. Okay, so here's a little log of executing those two fragments of code. I packed it all up into a function called doAll. That little argument here, too, just says pop up a particular window to look at some of the results. Okay, so remember we had the prompt for the model file name. It's going to be called blocks. I typed that in. Asked me for the number of classes, three classes. Asked me for where the training data comes from, the file stem. And I said it was sort of F1, F2, F3 was the name of the images. It turns out there's also a folder or directory name in front of it. And MATLAB's perfectly happy to deal with that. So this is the directory. And then there's the start of the file name. Here's the number of training images. And then it starts going on for the different classes. So it says, OK, what's the class of this first image? You know, whether it's class 1, class 2, or 3. And it just goes through and prompts me for as many training images as you want until finally, you finish. There was some sort of a prompt in there to say that I've done as many as I want and stop now. Okay, so that's the training, very easy. our execution, when we want to do our recognition, is this bit of code right here. And it's really virtually identical to the training code, with the exception of now we're going to recognize the class rather than train the class. So as before, we need to input the file stems. We need to load our model. So rather than using the save function that we had before, now we've got a load function that allows you to load from a disk file, a given disk file, a set of MATLAB variables. Okay, so you'll find that quite convenient for your coding as you save out intermediate results. You know, maybe you finished a practical work, you know, for today and you want to pick it up again tomorrow, but you want to save all the results that you've got sort of partially. You can do the save from before and you can just load them up again. Here's a loop where we're going to do the recognition. This is maybe a little bit that we haven't seen before. This little tilde right here is the MATLAB negate command. So I'm going to have a while loop that's just going to keep running effectively forever until the user inputs something that says stop. And that variable is going to be this variable run, and it says, well, while it's not the case that run equals zero, do this loop. I initialized it to one, so it'll at least get in there the first time. I index the image. I load in another image from the disk. I use the image read command. I convert it to gray. I extract the properties, all just like what we did a minute ago. Now we got a new function here. That's the classify function, where we pass in the data and also all of our model information. And that gives us a particular class. And notice that I didn't put a semicolon out here, so it's going to print the result out on the on your console. And then finally prompt to see if we want to run it again. So while the maths looks pretty sophisticated, the coding actually is not all that difficult. Okay, and very similar to the training code as well. So anybody want to ask anything about that? It's all pretty straightforward. Okay. Well, you might be wanting to use something like this in your first practical assignment. I mean, you've got these little colored blocks moving around. There's a possibility of confusing which one is which, whether it's the red or the green. Here we've been looking at geometric properties of the shapes. But in the case of the practical, you might want to look at color properties of the shapes. I mean, the geometry is the same. They're all sort of little sort of cylindrical disks. What distinguishes them really is the color. So you might want to look at using color as a possible way of solving the practical. Now, but that raises an interesting point. There's no really one right way to solve these practicals. There's a lot of different techniques that one could use. Some are certainly better than others. Okay, but there are different ways that you could solve the practical.
So it's will we be balanced on the results rather than the techniques?
The question is, will you be evaluated on the results rather than the techniques? And, well, it'll be a bit of both. I mean, I think, you know, you would be expected to use an appropriate technique, you know, and you know, you'd be expected to get good results. Okay, but the two kind of go together. If you get good results, then you're using an appropriate technique. So that's a bit ambiguous, I know, but I don't want to say use this technique because there's different things you could use.
But if you get good results, that would not so well, the case that we haven't covered in lectures, we still
do okay. Do you get good results if you use techniques that you haven't covered in lectures? That's fine. You know, you're there's the whole internet out there to go find stuff. But, yeah. Well, okay, now there is an important question of what is good results. So I've supplied you with two video sequences, but I've suggested that maybe you should take more sequences yourself. And, well, you should think about what kind of conditions to vary so that they're, you know, still in the context of the problem, but maybe not identical to those two particular data sequences I gave you. And, you know, if you have a technique that can kind of cope with different variations of, say, lighting or brightness or something like that, then maybe you've got a good technique. You know, but if you didn't explore too widely on the parameters of the videos, then maybe you haven't, maybe your technique might be good and maybe it wouldn't be good. That would be a case that technique might be fine, but the evaluation isn't as strong as it could be. Okay, so we've seen all the theory. We've seen the recipe. Let's eat the cake. Okay, so this is the results of running through my training samples on my classifier and getting the results. And this is a thing called a confusion matrix right here. And the it's a good way of presenting the results in summary for kind of classification problems, for example. So here is my ground truth. Actually, I think I probably got that wrong. These are the three correct classes. So I have four images of each of the classes. Okay, and these are the results that the classifier said for each of the three different classes. Okay, so all of the image samples of class A were classified as class A. All the samples from class B were classified as class B or class C. And all the samples from class C were classified as class C. So it did fine on A and C. It didn't do so well on B. Okay, what you're really looking for is all of the values along the diagonal and zeros off, because that means there was no misclassifications. It's useful to have these kinds of things because sometimes you can see, oh, well, all of the misclassifications maybe went into one particular class. And then you can go and look, identify features that maybe can discriminate between those two particular classes. This would be something that you might want to do with some of your video sequences in the practical, for example, as a way of evaluating how well you've recognized the different colors. You've got sort of red, green, blue as the colors of the little robots. And these are the classified colors. What went wrong here actually is one of the parts was flipped upside down, and one of the properties that was measured, of course, being upside down, it had a slightly different property for the moment invariance. The invariance that we have are invariant to translation, rotation, and scale, but they're not invariant to mirror images. At least one or two of them is not invariant to mirror images. Yeah. What's Sorry? There's a typo. Or you're absolutely right. Right. There also seems to be the rows and columns, I think, here are the either it's incorrect or it's badly written. So nah, that's interesting. I run these things through the spelling checker, but okay, so we have a Bayesian classifier now. You've seen all the pieces. It's a really simple classifier. It's statistically well-founded. It works in this particular case with the exception of the flipped over part. I didn't even realize that the part was flipped over until I ran it through and then said, oh, what was this? Then I went back and looked at the data and discovered actually when I'd taken the photographs of the part, by accident I'd flipped over that part. Okay. Otherwise, we had everything along the main diagonal. That's really, for real problems, that's pretty unexpected. You know, with our skin cancer work, with some of the things that we're looking at, we get about 80% of the samples are on the main diagonal and about 20% are off. That's actually pretty good results, but for real data. But anyway, the reason why it works so well here is that we've got features that really discriminate between the different kinds of parts. And that's the key to a good classifier, a good recognition. There's lots of different algorithms for doing the classification itself, but pretty much none of them will work if you have bad features. If your data doesn't, you know, the properties you're measuring don't discriminate between your classes, it doesn't matter what classifier you plug them into. So really, that's the final point, is we've got choosing good features right here, things that discriminate between the parts or the objects that you're trying to classify. Okay, so we have covered three interesting things here. Okay, one, there's a kind of general introduction to a Bayes classifier. Some of you will have encountered it already in IAML, some of you won't. And it's really kind of ubiquitous in you know, science these days, so, but you know, particularly, you know, computational science. In order to give us a distribution model, we have this multivariate Gaussian distribution. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Gaussian or normal distribution. I would guess that a fair number of you are not familiar with the multivariate distribution, and now you are. And finally, we've looked at one of the five different ways you can recognize objects, and in particular, we've looked at the property-based recognition. And this is actually kind of key to a lot of the contemporary sort of recognition work, except for using more sophisticated properties and things like that. Okay, so that's a good, that sort of finishes that little bit of lecture, and we'll have just a little break for a second as we before we go on to the next bit for maybe you have a question or, yeah. Okay, so I have a question. Remember, we're trying to find out pairs, so who doesn't have a partner for their practice? Put your hand up. Okay, I see 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people. Okay, so again, can I be a bit of a marriage broker and suggest you meet outside the door just right after the lecture and maybe you'll find yourself a partner? Okay, so I think there's, by my list, there are 26 students who do not yet have partners, 26 out of the 108 of you. And I guess 6 of them are here and the other 20 are still in bed or something like that. But that's their decision. Okay. Ready? Okay, well, the last thing we're going to do is a kind of a little extra topic for today, and it's a bit based on something called projective geometry. And sort of formally, mathematically, a projection is a non-singular transformation. Okay, I mean, non-singular basically means you can invert it. You can project one way or you can project back the other way. Okay, the maps points, in this case, maps points from one position to another. And here's an perfectly good example of that. It's related to imaging. Here is one image plane. We've got sort of 3 points in that plane. Here's another image plane. There's 3 points in that plane. Here's our camera origin that links all of those points together. And one can develop a projective transformation that maps every point in this plane to every point in that plane, and vice versa. You can go backwards from this plane to that plane. Okay, so that's an example of a projective transformation, and we're going to use that for something very somewhat almost unexpected, I guess. And this, I guess artists sort of knew about this, you know, since Durer or something like that, you know, developed sort of started the foundations and the mathematical basis for image projection. But computer vision people had not used it really up until about 10 years ago or so. And the idea is that you can take structures in one image and you can remap them into another image. So here I've taken the cover of this book and done something called projective transfer onto an array that just looks like that. It's a regular rectangular array. And when I do that projective transfer, I get an image that looks a little bit like this. Okay, and this could be very useful, for example, if you're tracking players on a football pitch. Okay, you've got a camera looking out over the pitch. Okay, you're looking at the pitch from a somewhat oblique point of view, and maybe you want to have so-called bird's eye view of the pitch to see where the players are moving. So you could take the view of my football pitch right here and transform it into a vertical view of the pitch. Okay, well, this only works for planes. Okay, at least for the bit that I'm going to tell you about here. Okay, it maps this image to that image right there. If this was a football pitch, there would be players sort of standing up. Okay, and they would also get mapped, but those players do not lie in the same plane. So when they get mapped over here, they'll get distorted. They'll look like little smears, you know, lying on this image rather than looking at the tops of their heads. Okay, that's because only their feet lie in this particular plane right here. Anyway, so that's a potential application. So we're going to look at the maths that does all of that. Okay, well, we're going to do a 2 dimensions to 2 dimensions projective geometry. And one can do it in other dimensions as well. And it's just basically a matrix multiply, of a certain kind of matrix doing the multiply so you can work in other dimensions. But we're just going to do the two dimensions, because that's images. Image is a two-dimensional structure. I'm going to map two-dimensional structures to two-dimensional structures. And this projective transformation deals with all sorts of stuff, sort of rotation, translation, shear scale, perspective distortion, lots of things right there. It's all bundled up in the same transformation, sort of the general class of projective transformation. Okay, the only thing that's a little bit complicated is that rather than work in our image coordinates, sort of row and column indexed, or sort of x and y, or row and column or something, we have to augment our representation by appending a 1 to it. Okay, because in this projective geometry, there's sort of an extra embedded dimension that we're going to have to deal with. Okay, so here is our original image coordinate position, and we're just going to re-represent it as that. Okay, so that's our notational extension. Right, so here is a slightly more complicated case. Okay, we want to reconstruct a virtual plane image, say, of our book cover. Okay, so that's going to be right here. And what we've got is our camera right here, so we've got our image. But not only is this image a plane and the book a plane, or sorry, the reconstructed image a plane, but also the book itself is a plane. Okay, these are all planes. They're two-dimensional structures, and we're going to link them all together by these projective transformations. So there's a projective transformation that maps the book cover into the image plane. So that's one plane to another plane. And what we want is a kind of virtual view of that book plane right here. And all we have is this. Okay, so we're going to have to somehow convert from this plane, viewing that plane, into this plane. But fortunately, because they're all planes, what links them all is still projective transformations. And the projective transformation is a linear type operator. So if we look at sort of the maths right here, we've got P1, which maps from plane 2 to plane 1. So that's the sort of plane 2 to plane 1. That's sort of the image transformation. And P2 maps from plane 2 to plane 3. And plane 2 to plane 3 is our virtual camera. Okay, so we've got two linear transformations. And because they are linear, what we want to know is we want to know this P3, which maps from what we observe to the result that we would like. And because they're linear, we can multiply these two transformations together to get this transformation right here. Okay, well, we're going to be able to sort of measure this one, estimate this transformation, and we're going to be able to specify this one because that's our result that we want. We say we want to look from above. We could use other angles, but here we're going to specify the result from above. So we can specify this projection and we can measure that projection, and that gives us our P1 and P2, and then from that we can get our P3, okay, by a linear, you know, just sort of multiplying them together. Okay, and in fact, we're not even going to have to multiply them together. We can just sort of go directly from plane 1 to plane 3. We'll see how to do that in a minute. Yep. You can kind of sort of see that right here. So P1 goes from P2 to P1. Okay, and really what we want is from P1 to P3. So the inverse of P1 goes from P1, plane 1 to plane 2. And then P2 does from plane 2 to plane 3. Okay, these are all invertible transformations. By taking the inverse, you go from, you know, going from this way to that way, from backwards, from that way to this way. Okay, so what that sort of tells us is we can get a projective transformation that goes directly from our view of the book cover to an orthogonal view of the book cover by even embedding these two transformations. And of course, one could use even more transformations if one wanted. And for example, you often see that sort of movies these days have a lot of augmented reality sort of built into the movie itself. They sort of cover up things that were sort of, you know, anachronisms in the movie or something like that. They hide things that shouldn't have been there when they did the recording. They also introduced sort of new things into the scenes, like these, you know, sort of Godzilla, you know, in the Godzilla movie or something like that. The techniques they use are really just based on these sort of projection matrices. You just need to have a good estimate of the matrix, and then you can project your model into the scene. Okay, so, right, let's sort of get down to a little bit more of the detail. Okay, so this projection matrix is what we're going to want to map from one image to the other. And it's a 3x3 matrix. Here are the 9 values in that matrix. And we want to estimate those values. We want to estimate the values that did the mapping here from this sort of image, this image of a plane, into this plane. Right. And once we have that matrix, we'll see how to estimate that matrix in a minute. Once we have that, then we can do our remapping really easily. Okay, here's our original image, okay, indexed with x and y. And here's our output image indexed by u and v. And I've used slightly different variables here just to, so it's easier to keep them separated. And assuming that we know this projective transformation that maps between the two, then we have this relationship between those image, this corresponding image points. So if uv is the point in one of the image and here's our projection matrix, then here's the x and y in the other image. And there is also this extra lambda in here. So there's an, as I was saying, remember we've embedded extra variables in here to give us a little extra structure. That's sort of related to this one down here. Okay, when you do this projective transformation, you get a result, actually you get a whole infinite family of possible results. You can kind of think a little bit of a reason why that sort of, you know, for normal projective sort of viewing, if I see, you know, your eye right here, it sort of maps onto a particular rod or cone in my eye. I see your eye, but I don't really know how far away your eye is. It could be here, it could be there, it could be further away, it could be off at infinity. All of those different distances all map onto the, exactly the same pixel in the projection into my eye. Okay, and that's how, that's where this lambda comes in. It says that there's an infinite family of possible things that all could have mapped onto this bit right here. Okay, well, we're going to have to get rid of that, but fortunately, you notice we've got two variables we're solving for, x and y. Actually, we've got sort of lambda x and lambda y, but we want to solve for the x and y out of that. But we've got three equations. There's the first equation, there's the second equation, there's the third equation. You all remember back from school, if you got, you know, extra equations, then you can solve for the variables you need. So if we got three variables, x, y, and lambda, we've got three equations, we can solve for them all independently. So in practice, what you do is you just, actually I think I've got that on the next slide. For each UV in the output image that I want, I do that projection right there. I find the lambda value from the bottom row of that. I divide the top two and get my lambda from the bottom row of my output vector here. I divide that lambda into the first two entries. That gives me my x and y. And that says, okay, which corresponding pixel from the input image do I need? And I go look at that pixel and get the color out, and I just sort of plunk it into my array for my output image. So I just do that for every pixel in the output image. I get the corresponding input pixel, and I copy the color over. That was all that was needed to do for this particular one right here. I just went through every pixel in the output image and mapped back to the corresponding input pixel and stuffed it into the array. Now there's only one thing left really to do. Actually, I should just ask, is that sort of clear so far?
Yeah?
What is the advantage of it? Well, I think the simplest answer is that's just the way we do it. So, but I mean, a slightly more sophisticated answer is that that's the nature of projective geometry. You know, in order to mathematically represent this effectively this infinite family of structure in the world, all of which could project into the same image, we need to have some unknown information, which is the distance to each of the things. And this, all these lambdas sort of sweep up all of that extra distance, okay, which is a sort of intuitive explanation. I think mathematically, one could just say, well, projective geometry is just an abstract mathematical object, and it has its own sort of laws and logic behind it. Fortunately, projective geometry is also good for explaining image projection and these kinds of transfer. And in that particular case, we have to make these adaptations that mean that lambda doesn't really quite mean anything, but you know, we have to use it here.
I think that the homogeneous coordinate allows you to do translations with matrix transformations. Mm. So there's one column that corresponds to the translation component of the overall transformation.
Yeah. The translation, Okay, so those of you who've done any like computer graphics have maybe used homogeneous coordinates for texture mapping or rotating and translating objects in your model space. So that's another application for the homogeneous coordinates right there. In this case, you have a three-dimensional vector representing the structure, and you add an append a 1 to the end of it. And as a consequence of that, you can put the whole projective transformation into one 4x4 matrix in this particular case. A simple version of it just has a rotation matrix and a column translation, as was suggested here. But you can also embed all sorts of other transformations in there as well, sort of shearing and perspective distortion and things like that also. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a 4x4 matrix or whatever. You can also add an image projection from the three-dimensional world down to a two-dimensional image plane. You can append that into the transformation as well. Right. Okay, so I just want to finish with one last bit right here. And the one thing that we have missed so far is how do we estimate the projection matrix? Okay, so that maps from one image to the other. And we're going to use a technique which is called the direct linear transform method, and it also has a kind of linear algebra trick embedded in it. Okay, we're going to have to estimate this matrix using a set of matched points. So I'm going to need somebody to tell me, for a set of points in the first image, what are the corresponding points in the second image. So in the case of my book, something or somebody had to find the pixel coordinates of these four corners and say that they correspond to the pixel coordinates of these four corners in the output image. So I need a number of those points, and the minimal number of points I need to estimate this plane-to-plane transformation is 4 points. Okay, more is better because 4 is the exact minimum, and if your points are a little bit noisy, then you've kind of got the embedded noise in. By having more points, it's better. That helps a kind of least squares, sort of a linear least squares problem, and it helps improve your estimates. But 4 is really all you need. Okay, so these are my data points that are an example of the projection. And here's my projection matrix, and I'm going to do a little trick here. It was a 3x3 matrix, but I'm going to unfold it into a 9x1 matrix, or sort of a 1x9 matrix right here. Okay, and I'm going to take my data, and I'm going to pack it in this particular form right here. Okay, so these are all the data values. This is for one point right here. It's going to turn into two rows in a matrix. And the reason for that is that if you take this little bit of the matrix and multiply it by this little bit right here, you should get 0. And that's kind of the equivalent, it's a reordering of the equations of this bit right here. If I substituted the variables from P in right in here and multiplied out these equations and got rid of the lambda, sort of substituting out for the lambda and got rid of that, I would get two equations in these four values right here and all the variables in P. And those two equations are effectively these two, sort of the, this little bit of A multiplied by that are the two equations right here. Okay, it's just a, it's kind of an algebraic rearranging sort of trick, but lots of people use this in computer vision. Okay, so that's for one point. I get that, those two equations. And now I've got n points, and I stack them all up. Right here, it makes a big matrix A, which is sort of n, 2n rows by 9 columns. Okay, it gives me a matrix right here. I use a singular value decomposition sort of trick in order to find effectively a least squares solution in here. And this p vector that I'm looking for turns out to be the last column of the eigenvectors right here. So it's the eigenvector of the smallest eigenvalue of A. It's a, it's kind of a standard sort of least squares estimation trick. I'm not going to go into the details of that here. Okay, but anyway, that's what you do. That this is all a bunch of data points from the two images. And you find that last column right here. That's your eigenvector right here. That's P. And then I take that P, which is a, you know, sort of a 1 by 9 vector, and I unpack it back into the 3 by 3 matrix P, right, that we saw before. And that gives us our projection matrix. And when you apply that projection matrix, doing exactly what I showed you right there, I get this transformation right here. Okay, so that's a little bit of an introduction to kind of a bit more sophisticated kind of computer vision mixed with a bit of graphics right here. You don't need to use this for your practical. I guess you could if you wanted to. You could find a way of doing projective transfer of their little disks that you see up into a kind of a vertical view. But it will be a little bit tricky because the disks are round circles. You're not going to be easily able to find these four corresponding points that you need in order to estimate that projective transformation. But you could do it with other things if you're interested. Right, okay, so that's the end of this bit of the lectures. I will be giving a couple more lectures on other topics in sort of computer vision in a week or two. I'm away next week. Michael Herman is going to be starting some of the robotics lectures next week. And then I've got one or two more lectures to give you later on in the semester. So, any last questions for the moment? Yeah?
The assignment, you specified that we should use median filter to compute the background. You said that we could use different techniques that don't. Does this apply to that as well? Because the median doesn't work very well.
Okay, well, it's interesting why it doesn't work very well. You can tell me after class. But yes, you can certainly use, the main question is, can you use other techniques? And the answer is yes, you can use other techniques. Yeah.
On slide 6, slide
31. Okay, yes, so there's a question of why is the matrix right here? Well, it's from the way I'm working with all my points as column vectors. So to transform a vector, you multiply the column vector by a matrix multiplying on the left. So when I apply this, effectively my transformation vector is going to be out here, and I'm going to use this first to go from P2 to P1. P1 to P2, right, and then use this matrix P2 to P3 right here. So if I actually apply it, the vector that I'm going to work with is out here as a column vector rather than a row vector. So that's why you do this transformation first, and then you do that transformation. And since I'm using that order, that's why they're in that order. Okay, I see that the next lecture is out there. So if any more questions, you can email me or talk to me after class. All right, thank you.
Question. I'm trying to find an IRR paper. Uh-huh. I'm interested in finding either patterns in images that are invariant to skew and turning points. Do you know
two-dimensional curves or?
building 3D models out of images. Do you know any papers in this field that are built for as a seed paper? Mm-hmm. Or do you know anyone who does work?
I have to think a bit more about it. Hang on a second, and then
okay.
I'll get other questions first. It's just too complicated for me to just think off the top of my head. Right. Okay, so.
In terms of the ordering here, it implies that